Do we have a sound? Before I begin, I want to make sure we get that I can be heard. There we go. We're working on it. We're getting it there. I want to do two things in this sermon. I want to talk about the Ten Commandments, and I want to talk about a change I made to our liturgy, our liturgical prayer, our Eucharistic prayer. So first of all, I want to talk about, in a rubric of all that, I want to talk about our connection to Judaism, actually. You know, if you look at a Bible, we've got the Old Testament and the New Testament. I mean, first of all, how many books are in the Bible? Or a lot of people think the Bible is one book, but do we actually know how many books it is? 66 books, right? The Bible is actually a library. It's not one book, it's a library written by many different authors over the course. I mean, that some of it begins in oral traditions that extend back deep history, and then a lot of it gets written, who knows, over the compilation of like 500, 600 years is the time frame that a lot of that comes together, and actually even more with the New Testament. I was thinking about the Old Testament, and then the New Testament is written, you know, even later, so over the course of 1,000 years. So there are ancient texts that are now at least 2,000, 3,000 years old, and it's in two volumes. There's volume one and there's volume two. We have a habit of calling volume one the Old Testament, but it is actually the Jewish scriptures. So if you go in a Jewish synagogue, the Old Testament is called the Tanakh. The order is a little bit different, but it's the exact same thing. And so our Bible is two-thirds, the volume one is the Jewish scriptures, volume two is the stories about Jesus and the early Christian movement, which branches out of Judaism. Jesus was a rabbi. His disciples were all Jewish men and women who kept kosher and kept the Sabbath and were all circumcised and went to the temple. Like, we forget that. All of those stories in the New Testament are actually about largely a bunch of Jewish folks. That then shifts with Paul. And Paul, is this pivotal moment where what has been inherent in Judaism all along is there's a sense that God has made a covenant with this particular group of people, but there's always a sense that God is there for all nations. And part of what happens in the Christian movement with Paul is this movement outwards to embrace all nations, Jew and Gentile. And so it spreads. And that's where we end up being today, is like we're all Gentiles, fundamentally. Most of us come out of are Gentiles. But we're in this deep relationship and connection with the Jewish tradition, right? And so we tell these stories about Abraham and how God makes a covenant with Abraham. And God says, I will be your God and you will be my people. And Abraham, and I'm going to make you the father of many nations, and your descendants are going to be numerous as the stars of the sky, and you're going to have a child. And Abraham laughs. He doesn't believe it because he's 99 years old and his wife is 90 years old. And it just doesn't work that way. And God just doesn't seem to get it. And then Sarah laughs when she hears the same promise. And so their first child is named Isaac, which means he laughs. Isaac has two boys, Jacob and Esau. Jacob's the younger, and he steals the birthright from his older brother. And Jacob then has 12 sons who become and many daughters. The daughters never get named, or most of them don't, unfortunately. It was a patriarchal system, but the boys have names, and they became the 12 tribes of Israel. Grace tried to correct that in our early history and named our tribes by the female names, right? So we have a history with that. You may remember, some of you. But anyway, so that is, and this God had made a covenant with these people, and these people end up going to Egypt because of a famine, and they end up becoming enslaved and in bondage in Egypt, and God sets them free. Right? And an important part of this story is God, this covenantal God, makes a covenant with God's people and sets them free, and brings them through the Red Sea and into a promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And the problem is there are people in the land already. And that's a problematic part of the story. And it's a problematic part back then, and it continues to be a problematic part of the story. And there's a whole history to that promise and how that promise gets interpreted and what we do with that promise. that still haunts us today, both in this nation with our relationship to when many of our European ancestors settled this continent, this nation, there were people in the land already. And we said, well, we're like the children of Israel. Right? And we appropriated that story and used it in a way that justified some of the killing and genocide that we did in this country. And we're haunted by that. Right? That story still haunts the land of Israel today. The state of Israel was set up in the 40s as a response to the Holocaust, and yet there were people that were still on the land. And we're haunted by that because those people get marginalized and put into the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And people try to wrestle with that. So they try to figure out, how can we both live together? How can both these nations, these people, live together? That's kind of the overall context. We're still living in this place. So God makes this covenant with God's people. And in the first part of the covenants, we talked about the covenant with Noah a couple Sundays ago, the covenant with Abraham. God says, I will be your God, you will be my people. When God gets up onto Sinai, God is then giving the law, which is actually God's people's side of the covenant. So in this covenant, God is saying, I will be your God. I'm making a promise to you. And in order to be my people, I need you to do these things. And that's where the Ten Commandments come from. These are the things that you need to do to be keepers of this covenant. And if you want to be my people and live in my way in the world. And, you know, I grew up in a Lutheran tradition where, you know, we were taught law was bad and grace is good. And so shun the law and embrace grace. You know, and then I went to seminary and hung out with some Jewish students and went to a synagogue and saw in this one service where the Torah, the law, the scrolls were kept on this table, and like we read the gospel, I come out here and I read the gospel in your midst. They do the same thing with the Torah. They bring the Torah into the midst of the people, and the people want to touch it, and the people want to bring it to their lips because it's sweeter than honey. Which is what our psalm said. Our psalm talks about how the law of the Lord is perfect and revives the soul. The fear of you is clean. Your judgments, you know, your laws are sweeter than honey, right? So from within the Jewish paradigm, these things are life-giving. And we've lost sight of it in some way. You know, you read the Ten Commandments, it's like, thou shalt not. Thou shalt not. I mean, that's kind of the music in our voice when we read these things. And you're like, oh, okay. I won't. Or maybe I will, just because you're telling me not to. You know, I don't know. Depends upon your I don't know what your predisposition is. Some of us are like, okay, I won't. And some of us are like, I don't know. The first commandment in the Jewish tradition is, I am the Lord your God. That's the first commandment. I am the Lord your God. Most Protestants don't start there, though. We start with, you shall have no other gods before me, and we call that number one. But the Jews are like, yeah, no, you guys got it wrong. The first commandment is, I am the Lord your God. And the second commandment is, therefore, since I am the Lord your God, you should have no other gods before me. Makes a lot of sense. And then you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Just like, what does that mean? I've struggled to understand what that means. And this week I was realizing, oh, if this is about a covenant that God makes with God's people, in the ancient world you would swear an oath by the name of your God. Like you would say, you would take on the God, your God's name and say, you know, by Jehovah, the great Jehovah, or El Shaddai, or whatever, I commit my way. And the third commandment is saying, don't do that lightly. Don't trod this path. Don't enter into this relationship without meaning and without purpose and without intention. Because it matters. It's something that matters. So don't do it in vain. Because if you do it in vain, it's a waste of your life force, of your life energy. Don't do it in vain. That's the third commandment. Do it as if it has meaning. Jesus, our rabbi, said, what is the greatest of all these laws? And Jesus said, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, that is the greatest. And he's summarizing these three commandments. That's what these three commandments are about. It's about how we love God. I am your God. Don't have other gods before me, and don't enter into this relationship in vain. That's what it's about. That's how you love your God. And then Jesus said, the second set of commandments is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And all the other rules are about loving your neighbor. So remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. I grew up thinking that was about loving God, like you got to go to church on Sunday, or Saturday if you're Jewish, or Seventh-day Adventist, or Friday if you're Muslim. You got to go to church to honor God, right? That's how I heard that. But, maybe there's a little bit of that in it, but it's actually, no. You remember the Sabbath day so that, and everybody in your house gets to remember the Sabbath day. So it's not just you. You get to take a break. God created this good earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God rests. So the seventh day isn't about somehow, Mark Twain was very famous about talking, parodying how boring Sundays were in church, right, at the time. It's not about being bored on Sundays so that you can honor God. It's about actually being able to enjoy the goodness of God's creation, which is what Sabbath is all about. And so if you get to do that, your children should get to do that, and your livestock should get to do that. Don't make your cows work on a Sabbath day. Seriously, don't. If you are, stop, right? Let them rest, because God cares about them. They're part of God's good creatures, God's good humanity. So don't make your lives, give your livestock a day of rest. That's in there, that's what it's about. And if you have servants or slaves, give them a day of rest. Right? This is how we love our neighbor, is by giving them a day of rest and not working them to death. It's something we should take seriously when we live in an economy where there are people who are trying to string together part-time jobs. So they have 2-3 part-time jobs, and they never get a day of rest because they can't make it work. We as Christians should be concerned about that. Oh, we have people who don't get a day of rest? Just in order to make their livelihood, they don't get a day of rest? I mean, that's a violation of the fourth commandment. We should think about that. You shall not murder. Period, right? Shall not murder. There's a rich tradition within you shall honor your father and mother, so that your days may be long in the land and your Lord, the God, is giving you. Our father and mother sacrificed themselves, and many of you know as parents the sacrifices that you make in order to raise your children. Many of you also know the mistakes that you make along the way and how your own failings often get worked out on your kids, and so many of your kids are going to need therapy, or many of us have needed therapy, right? Let's talk about honoring mom and dad. Like, so what does it mean to honor mom and dad when you've spent tens of thousands of dollars in therapy to undo what mom and dad has done? I wrestle with that continuously, quite honestly. But what I hear there is good that was done. Honor that. There was love there despite their failings. Honor that. Honor their hope and dream for you. That's in your best interest. Right? That's the way of love. You shall not murder. There are many Christians and people of faith, good faith, who've taken that seriously and have sought the path of nonviolence and eschewed war in any form, right? There's a rich Christian tradition behind that. Because God, who is the giver of life is precious and life is sacred, and it should not be taken. And so many people of faith have said, we will do everything that we can to avoid killing. There's also, within faith traditions, people have thought, well, sometimes there are people who kill, and you need to fight them or you need to stop them. There are people who are doing harm and things need to be done in order to stop their behavior. And so sometimes it feels like it is just to kill them to keep them from killing. And so we have a just war theory, right? So within our faith traditions, other people of goodwill have said there are times when it is okay to carry out a war of action to stop the killing. On October 7th, after the Hamas attack on Israel, I felt that a response, a violent response, a war was justified. But just war theory demands that you be carried out in such a way that the innocent are not harmed. And I can no longer with any integrity say that this is a just action. It feels to me like it has moved beyond being a just action and is now in violation of the fifth commandment. And that's true when you've got 13,000 children who are dead, who were innocent, and the appropriate actions to protect them have not been taken. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. I mean, these things are there because, like, if you're violating somebody's marital vows, if you're violating, you know, the integrity of somebody's relationship, that causes disruption and harm, that isn't a way of loving. You shall not steal. Don't take things from each other. Like, that is also a violation of their being, and it leads to disharmony and violence against each other, right? That this is about love. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This is the ninth commandment. I think this is in many ways the most important commandment today that we don't pay attention to. Now, you ask somebody, what is the ninth commandment? They're like, well, I don't know. I asked somebody the other day who should know, and he didn't know. Thou shalt not bear false witness, which means you shouldn't lie about your neighbor, which means you shouldn't engage in character assassination, which means that even if you disagree with them, even if you're in enmity with them, you need to tell the truth about their character and what they believe and why they might have good reasons for believing what they believe, even if you disagree with them. Right? Thank you. In our current political partisan divide, we fail to do this. And I think if Christians in our nation were to stand up and say, hey, you know what, we have a moral obligation to tell the truth about each other, even those we disagree with, that would do a big way of mitigating some of this partisan divide. But when the partisan divide is fueled by character assassination, or telling partial truths or not full truths about who the other is and what they believe and their own integrity in terms of why they believe what they believe, like, it destroys community, right? It's a profound failure to love. We need to be standing up for the ninth commandment and articulating the ninth commandment. And then finally, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, their servants, their oxen, their donkeys, or anything that belongs to their neighbors. So if you're coveting your neighbor's donkeys, stop. Don't. That's the Ten Commandments, right? And you can see in them that this is a guide. This is a guide for us in terms of how we should act. The whole Jewish Torah is in some sense an explication of these things, right? So even though there's all these rules in Leviticus, they're actually a fleshing out of what this looks like. And so Judaism is in many ways a trying to live into this. And as Christians, I think we should actually try and be trying to live into this, because this is, you know, this is part of what God has said. Hey, if you want to love me with your whole heart, mind, and strength, and you want to love your neighbor as yourself, this is a way. This is the way to do it. This is connected to what I want to say next. This week, Beulah came to me with this piece of paper that she had cut out from last week's bulletin. And it was from the Eucharistic prayer. So this Eucharistic prayer that I've been using is, I think, from the Lutherans up in Canada. And one of the phrases in that Eucharistic prayer was, "Praise to you for bringing the Israelites safely through the sea." And then the response was, "Praise to you for leading your people through the wilderness to the land of milk and honey." So praise to you for bringing the Israelites safely through the sea. Praise to you for leading your people through the wilderness to the land of milk and honey. That's a reference to this story that I've just been talking about. So liturgically, we use that phrase to talk about how God frees God's people from their bondage to slavery and how God leads them into a promised land. And Beulah came up to me and she said, in the context of what's happening in Gaza, this is really problematic. I didn't use those words, but that's the essence of what you were saying. It's jarring. And as I sat with it this week, I realized that I can't, because there's a chance that it feels like this is supporting what the Netanyahu regime is doing currently, I can't in good conscience use that language. Because I can't in good conscience support what's happening. I did, on October 7th, I did feel that a just response is. And I think as people who are part of a Jewish this Jewish tradition, we need to stand with Jewish people everywhere. We need to stand for and respect and honor the integrity of their faith and their faithfulness and their religious practices. We need to stand against anti-Semitism. I think we can align with their aspirations for safety and security and for home. That's one of the reasons why I supported and still do a two-state solution. And so I think it's important for people of faith that we do that. And I don't want what I'm saying to be any way interpreted against that. But we are also Gentiles. And the movement of God isn't just for one people group. The movement of God has been for every people group, including the people who were in the land before the Jews showed up in the land, including the people of Palestine, including the Palestinians. As people of faith, we need to also stand with them, stand for justice for them, stand for the integrity of their faith. We know that many Palestinians are Muslim, most of them are Muslim, but many of them are Christian. We need to stand for the integrity of their own faithfulness, whether they're Muslim or Christian. We need to stand against Islamophobia or any kind of ways, things where they're being demonized and there's contempt, in the same way we stand up against anti-Semitism. And we also need to support their need for safety, their need for a homeland, their need for justice. And what's happening currently isn't just. And I personally don't think that what's happening currently has moved beyond a just war and is now violating the Fifth Commandment. And I do that, for the integrity of our worship, I changed this phrase. Because I don't want our language to seem to be supporting the Netanyahu regime and what's happening currently. And so I changed the language to, "Praise to you for leading your people out of bondage into freedom. Praise to you for bringing your people through the wilderness to their new home." It's still the essence of the story. But it's not in any way, I think, colluding with or supporting something that I don't think with integrity we should be supporting. I welcome your feedback around this. I'm just trying to be transparent for you about a decision I made regarding our worship and where I stand with these things. I know that this is a hard issue for people on all sides of this matter. And I think as people of faith, I'm committed that we are called to love. And that means loving both Jewish people and loving Palestinians and Muslims. And we're in a moment where we have to figure out how to do that when there's conflict, the kind of conflict that's going on right now, and recognizing our complicity in it. Yesterday, our government, to its credit, dropped 38,000 meals, airborne meals, that were culturally appropriate. They were halal. So they're MREs that are halal. Good on us. 38,000. Problem is there's almost 2 million people near famine in that strip of land. So we've dropped 40,000 meals, and there's almost 2 million people who are almost starving. Starving due to a war that we fund. That's a problem. And I think we need to wrestle with these things. Amen.